What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off.
Lisa Shields is FiSpan's founder and CEO. She previously founded Hyperwallet System, which sold to PayPal for $400 million. In this conversation, we discuss the difference between marketing and sales, building an intentional business, open banking, embedded banking, rise of fintechs, and the importance of data ownership. I really enjoyed this conversation with Lisa, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into the episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up is BlockFi. BlockFi is killing it. I'm an investor, I sit on the board, and I'm a big-time user of the platform. BlockFi provides financial products for crypto investors. Those products include high-yield interest accounts, U.S. dollar loans, and no-fee trading. You should start earning today. You can visit BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, BlockFi.com/pomp. Go try out BlockFi and then tweet at me and let me know what you think. Next up is Bybit. Bybit currently has over 300,000 users, with the number growing in double-digit percentages monthly. The exchange has no overloads during volatility and low-latency trading plus 24/7 customer live support. At Bybit, they listen, they care, and they improve to provide the best possible trading experience and create a faster, fairer, and more human trading environment. Go check out Bybit. You can use the link in the description of this podcast. Lastly, don't forget that I write a daily letter to over 75,000 investors about business, technology, and finance. I break down complex topics into easy-to-understand language while sharing my personal opinion on various aspects of each industry. You can subscribe at pompletter.com. Again, pompletter.com. All right, let's get into this episode with Lisa. I hope you guys enjoy it.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I've got Lisa here with me. Thank you so much for doing this.
Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. All right, let's jump right into your background. You have a very, very cool story and have had one major exit, and hopefully you're on your way to the second major exit as an entrepreneur. But what did you do kind of before you started building companies?
So I'm one of those accidental entrepreneurs. I was always the irritated engineer in, you know, a technology company that thought, you know, management and the salespeople were always doing the wrong thing by the customer, and I could do it way better than anybody else. Small side story, 8 years later, after I started Hyperwallet, I actually called some of my old bosses and apologized to them because then I knew how hard it was. But the background really is, so I was a working engineer in aviation information systems and made the switch to payments 20 years ago when online shopping became a thing. And I took that job simply because I was interested in the technology, you know, internet databases. And really quickly, I became intrigued by online commerce and the impedance in things like international payments. And the truth is, it was 1999. We were all partying like it was 1999. And we thought, hey, we can do it better. We're not going to let ignorance stand in our way. We're going to found a company. So that's the honest backstory of how I, you know, founded a payments company. And then it was a long inculcation into like how the industry works and how to find a value prop within it.
Got it. And so that business was Hyperwallet. You end up scaling it, and PayPal eventually bought that business for about $400 million, is my understanding. Maybe just tell us kind of what was the original idea you guys had, and then kind of how did you scale that product and kind of build something valuable enough for a large company like PayPal to come in and buy it?
Sure. So the story of Hyperwallet is twofold. One, undercapitalized, and a bunch of engineers building products looking for a market. So really, Hyperwallet was an 18-year overnight success story. And what we built that was really interesting was something that in the industry is now called cross-border ACH, but the ability to do compliant and very cost-effective, low-value cross-border payments. So, you know, any idiot can compliantly send $300,000 from the United States to France and take a, you know, couple hundred or $1,000 commission for the foreign exchange and fees along the way. But if you want to send $300 from the United States to France for a business paying out a 1099 worker, for example, that's actually not easy to do at a price point and a compliance level. So that's the platform that Hyperwallet slowly built over the years, was the ability to do take advantage of local in-country, low-cost clearing networks. So we slowly built a global network of networks, if you will. But the business was still really small. And so when it became more valuable was around 2010, when a salesperson, a sales executive actually joined and said, look, instead of trying to point this at individual consumers or point this at banks, let's point this at corporates that really need to pay many, many hundreds of thousands of 1099 workers. So that was the direct selling industry. Think Mary Kay, Herbalife, those kind of companies had a real problem. And ultimately what we were competing against was checks in FedEx packages, right? And then what really provided the tailwind for that business was the evolution of the marketplace and marketplace-like businesses. And so it was a low, slow burn. Slowly, we had bootstrap and made it profitable because we had to. We found a vertical niche that ultimately became more valuable as a horizontal play.
And what was your biggest lessons learned as you kind of built that business, right? Because it sounds like you kind of went through all the ups, the downs, and the excitement and the tough times. What were the biggest lessons you took away?
Well, one is as an entrepreneur as a product-focused entrepreneur, sales is not bad and revenue is not bad. And, finding your market is not bad and actually servicing the customer is not bad. So I learned the difference between marketing and sales, which is a tough, tough lesson for an engineer to actually comprehend. But the other, more relevant to financial services is it's building layer upon layer of what's there is okay. Trying to drill right down and build something brand new, and I call it like fighting City Hall in the industry, is a bit of a mug's game. And unless you have the ability to raise billions of dollars, that's kind of not a battle you want to be in. So that was my other lesson.
Yeah. And then talk a little bit about kind of when the company actually was acquired. Was that, hey, we think that they can take it further and farther, with us? Is that something, hey, I wanted to go work on another thing? Like kind of what was the impetus and really the idea being there's a lot of founders who listen to this and they dream of one day having their company acquired, right? Or taking it public. And so how did you kind of go through the evaluation of what to actually do before you did that transaction?
Let me preface it that I actually stepped down from an operating role in 2015. So I was still on the board and still very much involved, but not as a management and not sort of stewarding the business. But what I can say is it was time to provide liquidity to our shareholders. So that absolutely was part of the motivation. And when you think about it, we were profitable and growing, but within Hyperwallet providing payouts, there was only so much the business could do and grow. And with the regulatory complexity, the opportunity to find a bigger platform that can marry pay in and payouts, right? So think about from PayPal's perspective, putting Braintree and Hyperwallet together to compete against the likes of the Stripes and the Audience of the world that are coming up. That was very exciting. So to broaden the applicability of the platform, and be part of something big and see that, see that baby that we built really continue to grow beyond what we could do. It sounds trite, but that actually was part of it.
No, that makes complete sense. And then once you decide, hey, I'm going to go do this again and go bash my head against the wall and build another company, did you have an idea as to what you wanted to build or did you kind of make the decision, let me build a company and then I'll go find what idea I want to work on?
Is really interesting. This, the genesis story of Fiespen is completely different than the like bottle of Chardonnay and hey, this is a great idea of Hyperwallet. Because I did have the benefit of 18 years in the industry. So I call Fiespen a very intentional business. I literally sat in my basement for a year thinking about different business ideas, because this is the one truth about founders. If you had have asked me in 2012 if I would start another company, let alone a financial services company, I would tell you only an idiot would start a payments company. And only like a super idiot would try and do this again. But you know, we have a very, very selective memory, and all the highs and lows of running a business, you forget all the terrible lows when you want to shoot yourself in the head, and you only remember all those great times, right? So, but Fiespen is very, very intentional. And I certainly took some of the market observations from the Hyperwallet time. And a couple of things were, one, that all the hype in financial services is in the retail side, because that's what everybody knows. You know what it's like for you to use a credit card or for you to use Apple Pay, right? You know when you get irritated about, you know, your bank's online banking. So that's where all the hype is and a lot of the attention. But I really believe that there's huge opportunities to make the world better for businesses. And the second thing I knew, being an intentional start to Fiespen, was I didn't want to compete against banks. I fundamentally had this thesis that banks have superior payments products, superior cash management services, superior loans, because they have a lower cost of capital. Like just think about the fundamental underlying attributes. But they have really struggle with, you know, that quote unquote delightful user experience. So I literally sat there and I was like, you know, is there an opportunity to introduce a company and a business model into the market that's sort of the opposite of Plaid's, where you're not aggregating banks for third parties to own the customers, you're aggregating the endpoints to allow banks to better service their customers. So that's the genesis story of Fiespen. A, forgot the bad times. B, had enough, wanted to do it again. And C, there was just so much opportunity.
Yeah. And so this is a really interesting kind of framework you provided of like, there's plenty of people out there who said, hey, we're going to aggregate all the banks and then allow the third parties to have that relationship with the customer. You essentially are doing something opposite, right? Kind of taking the thing that everyone sees value in and has kind of been funding for a while, and you flipped it. Why was that where you wanted to go? Did you have kind of a contrarian view saying that, you know, the other people just don't see this opportunity? Was it a skill set or an experience that you had? But like, how did you identify that where maybe others haven't spent a lot of time?
So there were some actual data points, conversations with CFOs and treasurers back in my Hyperwallet day, where what Hyperwallet had done, yes, we had this fantastic low-cost mass B2C service, and we'd exposed ourselves through APIs to be in the Cool Kids Club. But we'd done one more thing, which is our engineers had integrated our products and our APIs into our customers' business system of record. These are big, publicly traded, billion-dollar companies. And that fact engendered a lot of love. And when I would go back and talk to my customers, they would say, hey, can you provide us B2B payment services? Can you provide us with cash management services? Can you provide us with foreign exchange? And I'd be like, why? I'm just this tiny little undercapitalized company. Why would you even offer me? And so what they'd said is, look, I'm highly banked, but what my banks offer me is a file spec. And now I need to go out and hire someone to integrate it with my workflows. And then I have a separate process. And then my internal controls are shot. And then I have an additional audit cost. So that was the specific insight, right? It wasn't like I decided it's very clever to have a contrarian view to the market. It was that there was sufficient pain points by corporates that they were willing to engage with third parties for like what I call fundamental transactional services. And so like, quite frankly, it was just opportunistic. I thought, look, I don't want to build something from scratch, but if I can arm banks to really service that need, that's better for the customer and better for the banks.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so talk a little bit about kind of what was the first product you built and kind of what does that product or product suite look like today?
Yeah. So fundamentally, what we like to say at Fivespin, we bring business banking into the customer context. And what we mean by that is, like, from the customer's perspective, it's about jobs to be done, not a bank product to be used, right? So I want to keep current with my overseas customers. I don't want to send a wire, right? I want to forecast my cash. I don't want to log into online banking to view my balances. So in practice, what we do is we embed commercial banking services within other applications. And the first and, you know, most important experience is embedding inside accounting and ERP applications. So we bring those bank services in context. Easiest way to think of it is by example. I'm inside my ERP. I've gone through my workflow to approve a vendor invoice. I just want to click and have this vendor invoice paid. I don't want to care whether it's like ACH, check, print, wire, right? I just click. It's going to be paid. I know which bank account it's going to be out of. Tomorrow, when all the, like, the magic has happened, that object is going to be automatically updated in my ERP. All the track and trace information is there. Open banking, APIs, you know, host-to-host connectivity can make that all happen. Making that all happen seamlessly without the customer worrying about it is what we do.
So there's a whole bunch of kind of magic that happens. And I always describe the type of business that you're in is you want the customer to know about you when you're selling them to use the product. And then when they're using the product, you almost don't want them to know you're there, right? Because you're basically kind of magically doing all of these things that just make their life easier. And part of this is there's these two key ideas, right? So there's open banking and then there's embedded banking. And maybe we can talk through open banking first. What does that mean and kind of how is that playing out in just fintech in general? And then how are you guys actually interfacing with open banking?
Yeah. So, open banking, you know, means different things to different people. You know, it can be regulatory driven, but by and large, what it means is an obligation of a financial institution to make its customers' data and services accessible to third-party applications and endpoints, right? So it's where the bank will expose a security and authentication paradigm that somebody else can come to, whether it's, you know, PIM, right? So PFM, personal financial manager application. And I can aggregate all my bank accounts inside this third-party application. Open banking requires the bank to say yes to that third-party inquiry to receive my balance and transaction histories. And in different jurisdictions, it actually almost always is a regulatory initiative, right? Like bank thouest must. So what open banking brings to the industry is a set of, you know, application, you know, APIs that developers and third parties can consume to make these things happen. At Fivespin, we think embedded banking is an outcome of this technology, this API interconnectivity in a permissioned and secure way. But embedded banking can be a result of open banking, or it can be a result of, like, an industry initiative. So we happen to service at Fivespin North American and primarily US financial institutions where there is no obligated open banking. So we integrate with our banks in a trust model and then create those APIs for the bank. So I'm not sure if that answered your question. Open banking is the set of technologies and regulatory obligation. Embedded banking is the embodiment of that for the benefit of customers.
Got it. And so the open banking aspect is really just providing way more connectivity between all of this infrastructure, these organizations. And the way I've thought about it, and you're the expert, so you're going to correct me if I'm wrong here, is kind of what the internet did to connect organizations, people, infrastructure, et cetera. Really, open banking is just doing that in a kind of a single niche vertical of finance and banking, right? It really is this idea of like, how do we use these digital tools to provide much more connectivity and reduce friction across everyone?
Yeah, great part example, of it. Right? I can go back, I can see you and trump you on that analogy.
All right, let's hear it.
I can go back another generation and talk about ODBC, right? Which was a like database, you know, open database, whatever it was, like connect. So this was a technology. Open banking is like a technology and concept that enables greater access to an asset that can, you know, provide value to the owners or users of that asset. Whether or not a specific database provider, whether Oracle endorsed ODBC and opened up its database through this new paradigm, was its own internal decision, right? And your analogy of the internet enabled this much greater, you know, access, connectivity, interoperability. It would be up to an individual industry whether it wanted to offer its services and products online. That's where we are with open banking right now. The promise of it is huge and enormous. Banks are trying to figure out whether and how they want to participate in this and, quote unquote, what's in it for them.
And then the idea of this kind of embedded banking, that really is more of leaning into this theme that, like, it feels like every technology company is somehow becoming a fintech, right? I mean, it seems like every single business is in some manner trying to incorporate some financial service, right?
Yeah. And so I would argue that that doesn't mean every single business is trying to become a fintech, that embedded banking allows every single business to make use of a fintech service for the betterment of its product and service delivery. Now, some do want to become fintechs. So an accounting system like QuickBooks that wants to offer a payment service and monetize it, that's one strategy. But an accounting system that just wants to provide the best account, you know, the best experience for its customer, not necessarily monetize it, is another example of, you know, somebody who's going to benefit from open banking.
And so what does this mean for the banks themselves, right? I think that we've kind of historically, there was a line in the sand, and it would be like a kindergarten teacher saying, okay, all the banks on the left side and all of the technology companies on the right side. I don't think you can do that anymore because that line is very, very blurred. So those traditional banks, what happens to them, or are they actually beneficiaries of all of this?
Kind of massive beneficiaries. And that was, you know, when we go back to the like founding thesis of FISBAN, is I always saw open banking and, you know, the API economy as just an enormous opportunity for banks, not a threat. But everyone's worried about being disintermediated, right? So if my customer is using my payment service and it's not my brand, they're not clicking on like my button, somebody else's, that's scary. But what I fundamentally believed is open banking has the possibility of bringing as much actionable but new data into the bank domain as it does to take data out of the bank domain and put it in the, you know, hands of third parties. Specific example again is, imagine with connectivity to a customer's accounting system in a permissioned way, bank could now have real-time and continuous access to that business's open receivables, income statement, balance sheet. And now, instead of inferring the best customers to lend to and, you know, making a guess at the underwriting, imagine if, with permission of the business, the bank could shave a few basis points off of a loan offer, make the lending experience absolutely seamless. And that treasurer just looks at his forward forecast and says, yes, I'll take this $2 million of working capital starting from here to here, you know, and then loan servicing. That's the promise. And so these other endpoints and these other applications that will be embedding financial services in them, if you take the data and information out of them, it allows the bank to provide a better product and a better service to its customers.
So one of the things that over the years absolutely shocked me about anything banking and finance related was how non-predictive the technologies were. Everything was pretty much counting what was happening, facilitating things that are happening now. But it was very hard, I think. And some of that was due to lack of technology. Some was due to lack of data. Some was due to lack of just time and energy spent building it on more like the predictive analytics and kind of using what we know today to tell us what's going to happen in the future. It feels like this open banking and embedded banking kind of busts down that wall and creates a world where there's so much data and there's so much technology and so many integrations that there really can be, and maybe there is being, a very big rise in a lot of these predictive technologies.
Completely agree with you. But what's interesting is that's where I think this theme of new kind of data companies is what is the next thing.
Okay,
so
explain
today,
that.
Yeah, so today everybody's trying to act on, these breadcrumbs that we leave all around the world, right? And a bank or somebody else is trying to say, hey, which are the best customers to lend to based on what's happening with this business on LinkedIn, how many people they're hiring, what they've bought, et cetera. And what I think is the future and what we've based our company on is what I'm calling like the custodial age of data. And what I mean by that is that the new kind of data opportunities will morph from their current state, which is this massive amount of side effect information that you then need to apply AI onto to, you know, make sense of. She read an article on business process automation, right? And so let's feed her ads for every CRM and workflow app out there for the next 12 months. I'm currently experiencing that, so it's one of my pet peeves, right? Instead of Finespan, we think that the most interesting opportunities will arise from the intentional sharing of actual data and actual intent with bounded and enforced usage rights around that data. And so when you talk about like the AI implications, right? Instead of having it being artificial information, what about having it being actual information? And the best predictor of the future is actually the past, right? So the most interesting new platform businesses, in my opinion, won't be the ones that are amassing the most data, but instead they'll be the platforms that provide the best access, data owner control, and watermarking services to the data exchanges that matter, right? And the data exchanges that matter, I believe, are between a bank and its customers.
And okay, so let's dig a little bit deeper on that, because I think it's a really interesting view of the world. Historically, let's take social media companies, finance companies, all these different types of companies. They basically had a couple of different assets. Most financial investors would look at how much revenue do you have, what's your profitability, how many users do you have, all of that kind of stuff. Inside of the companies, and literally I worked at Facebook for 2 years, so I know, the more access to information you have, the better you can make the product, the more personalized, the more contextual, the longer somebody will stay, the more ads you can serve. One of the assets is definitely the more information I get the user to give me, the better this is for us as a company, right? It's kind of one of the key tenets. What it sounds like you're talking about, and that's true to banks and others as well, right? It's kind of sure. The more information, the better. What you're talking about is actually almost flipping the model and saying, no, the winners of tomorrow are going to be the people who don't look at it as from the corporation seat. Instead, they look at it from the user seat and they say, what can we as a business do to empower this user to have the best experience, the most privacy, the most efficiency, kind of all of that? And a lot of it's actually going to be not to hold on to the data. It's going to be to give the user the data, to give them permissioning, to give them all sorts of tools that maybe historically they haven't had because incentives weren't aligned between the corporation and the end user. Is that fair to say?
That's not only fair. That's probably a better way of saying it than I do at my pitch. So I'll invite you to my next sales pitch.
No. You do a fantastic job.
But in all seriousness, like when I, as I talked about, founding Finespan, sitting there quietly in my basement, Googling away, I believe that the value of Finespan to our customers, the banks, and ultimately to allow them to provide value to their customers is precisely because I, as FiSpan, assert no ownership or usage rights over any of the data that traverses my network, right? So, and the apps I build on behalf of the bank, so our JP Morgan Chase, you know, ERP extension isn't branded FiSpan. It's branded JP Morgan. It's a service of JP Morgan Chase to their customer. But nonetheless, if it's a product I'm building permissions inside of it, right? And if when you click and install this extension and you say, I agree to share the vendor file, my vendor file with the bank, it's not for the purpose of the bank marketing to those vendors. It's for the purposes of the bank to you know, provide me with a better accounts payable risk management experience or something like that. So that's just our policy. And we think that that's going to build value in the future. And we are an example of a new kinds of, you know, data platform, but there'll be, you know, many more other kinds of examples of that.
Got it. And then in terms of that from a product building standpoint, do you have to have full end-to-end encryption so that not only do you not have ownership or usage of the data, but you actually can't see it? Or is this a situation where you kind of can't really do the job that the product's intended to, right? If you can't see the data. So it's kind of like this hybrid model of you don't want ownership, you don't want usage. It's more of just like a permission that the user told me to do X with their data. I go do that job and then I don't do anything else until they tell me to do something else, right?
Yeah. We're not there yet. And so I absolutely see what you're saying, but it just happens that our business model is we're both a technology outsource and servicing outsource component of the bank. So in order to service the clients, we need to see that data.
Yep, and that's what that would be my expectation. That it's different for like, and for those that are listening who may not who may think that we're in the weeds here for a second. Take Facebook, for example. If Lisa and I are both on Facebook and I send her a message, other than for advertising purposes, there's no need for Facebook to be able to read what message I sent to Lisa or what message she sends back to me. So you can have kind of full end-to-end encryption where only Lisa can read it or only I can read it. Facebook doesn't need to see that. Now, Facebook would like to see it because they'd like to target us on advertising, whatever. But for the intent and purposes of what we're trying to do in communications, end-to-end encryption makes a lot of sense. When it comes to this information, though, you can imagine if you interacted with your bank, but they couldn't see the amount that you were sending, they really can't kind of do their job, right? So there's certain pieces of information, obviously, that they need, which would make sense in this situation.
Yeah. So where we're also not there yet from a technology perspective is, there's OAuth, there's all sorts of encryption, tokenization. That technology exists, but I haven't yet seen an embodiment of the what I'm calling watermarking of data, which is like having its intended permissions around its usage being enforced end to end. So that technology doesn't exist, but we're starting to, within the industry, have discourses about it. So whoever invents that, I think will be, and it's not going to be me, but that will be another example of a very valuable technology and business to be introduced.
And is this the idea? So there's a lot of people, myself included, who believes that kind of every stock, bond, currency, and commodity will get digitized in the future. And so let's take equity, for example. It would be awesome if the equity was in some sort of token or digital format, and it could prevent a non-accredited investor from buying an asset it's not supposed to from an accredited investor, right? And kind of, it's almost like this self-governance through an automated technology because the asset itself has rules and kind of regulations coded into it. It sounds like that's what you're talking about here.
It's exactly what I'm talking, like a different analogy, but it's like the data that traverses, again, we'll use that example of, if I'm a business and I'm going to share my list of all my vendors with my bank, right? And the purpose is to help me reduce accounts payable fraud, right? It's that purpose of the data, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I'm talking about is when that data is now conveyed to the bank, today at FiSpan, I can pass along those permissions, but I can't enforce them. I can't, like, once that data is at the bank, except contractually, like, they know what they're supposed to do, but the actual owner of that data, today I'm not providing him or her with an audit trail of exactly where that data went and what it was used for after it's gone out of my system. That's not a technology that I'm going to build, but I would love to see it, because once we have something like that as a standard, then the opportunity for data owners to actually decide how much of, you know, to really have control and confidence and be able to choose to use Facebook or not, right? To me, that's interesting. I'll hopefully be done by then. But.
Absolutely. And I think that will happen at some point. It's just, to your point, who builds the technology and kind of how do they implement it first, right? Is it equities? Is it currency? Something like that. I would be absolutely berated on the internet if I didn't take the time while I had you to talk a little bit about digital currencies. You spend all day dealing with large banks, bank customers, kind of financial technology. What have you seen from a viability standpoint, whether it's, you know, a U.S. digital dollar, a digital euro type thing, so kind of a central bank-backed digital currency? There's the private currencies like the Libras that have been kind of thrown out there as ideas, or even into the cryptocurrencies like the Bitcoins and things like that. Is there conversation about that in kind of the world that you operate in? Is it people are aware of it and they don't really care and don't talk about it? Just give us an idea of kind of like what you've seen so far on the ground.
Yeah. In my simple world, businesses aren't asking. I'm a really simple person. At Hyperwallet, we were all about enabling different sorts of, payee directed. If you wanted to, company is sending you $300. If you want to have that direct deposit in your bank, cool. You can do that under your control. If you want to pick up cash at Western Union, cool. You can do that under your control. So when digital currencies and Bitcoin and Ethereum first came out, I was and still am like a fangirl just because of the technology, the prospect of it. So I really thought that Hyperwallet ourselves should become an endpoint. But this is, going back to our beginning, this is after 2012 when we're quote unquote a real company that was making real money. So not just a bunch of engineers building the next cool thing. So I actually went to my head of development. I said, I think that we should become an endpoint, at least on Ripple, because it's, it's in the cool kids club, it's banked last Stripe. And we went out and serviced our customers. And they were like, okay, we have no interest in it. So fast forward to now where I am at FiSpan. I'm trying to build applications that, move the peanut forward a little bit for end customers. And to be honest, I'm not excited about digital currency for, B2B payments. I've never thought that the rails were the problem. It's always been the endpoints in those consumptive applications. So I fundamentally don't think the world needs another payment rail. Taking aside the political view of unstable currencies and bad governments and everything else. Where I'm most excited about distributed ledger technology is around things like taking massive costs out of regulatory burdens, doing things like encrypting your KYC file on a customer as a bank, putting that on some like Ethereum-like block or whatever chain you want, and then having only permissioned and who's opening that little secret package and why. To me, this can take enormous cost and operational burden out of things like sending a wire from the United States to Thailand, where a bank today has to have a direct correspondent relationship. It's slow, it's horrible. Imagine if you could just put this delivery request onto an Ethereum block and onto some blockchain. Any delivery point in Thailand can pick it up and say, yes, I'm going to deliver this money to this endpoint. If and only if I get a regulatory hit, meaning like the Thai regulator says, whoa, that's on my KYB watch list, then I'll pick up this package, unencrypt it. You'll know about it. The customer will know about it. And the purpose of us accessing this data will be known. So long-winded explanation, but that's what I'm most excited about in financial services for blockchains and distributed ledgers.
How far away are we from that?
There's a number of initiatives actually started. And, you know, again, it all gets mired down into the business model. I know for a fact that, you know, JPMorgan Chase has started something exactly like that. Swift has their own initiative around something exactly like that. And what's interesting is banks are getting, and of course, I immediately was like, oh, I want to participate, right? Just because it's like, it's not directly related to what I do, but it is like sexy and interesting. So some aspects of like the kernel of being like a nerdy engineer never truly leave you. But we are, so the answer is we're close to having services like that. Actually, we're not just close. Services like that are in beta now. What now has to happen is the various people have to, you know, think about their position in the market and how do they want to play on somebody else's sandbox? Because even though these things are open and owned by nobody, you know, they're still perceived to have, you know, my competitor is behind that one. Do I want to play? But it is exciting and it is coming.
Got it. What do you kind of foresee as the future path for the company, right? As you've kind of built FiSpin, like where are you headed? And maybe not what the finish line is, but kind of what's like the big milestone that you say, hey, when we get there, like that'll have accomplished the goal.
Yeah. I actually can answer that.
Good.
It's when there are applications being built, not by FiSpin, that are actually delivering value. So we want to become an open banking. We want to support API programs and developer programs. And I want to have as delightful a developer experience as Stripe does, right? Where any, you know, Bob and Joe McKenzie can be in their basement, have a great idea for servicing, sign up and start actually providing value like on day one. When I have, so to answer your question, when I have 500 applications interoperating with my banks and they're not built by FiSpin, then I'll be a happy person.
I think that's a fair way to look at it. I wrap up every interview with the same two questions for everyone. The first is, what is the most important book that you've ever read?
So you can tell that I didn't actually see that. It was actually a biography of Mao.
Oh, explain that. Why is that your answer? That's a great answer.
Well, first of all, I'm trying to think all the books I read. I was really into different biographies of different despots. The overlay of, you know, history and individuals and despots coming together, and, you know, the Cultural Revolution. So I just found it really interesting. I didn't find it informative as to how I want to comport myself. But that was the most influential book that I've read.
That's a great answer. You're first person to ever say that one. That's great. I have one more question. It's a little bit more fun. And then you actually get to ask me one question to end it. But my question is about aliens. Are you a believer or a non-believer?
Total believer.
Why?
Because it's infinite. And the concept is like, it's simple math. The answer is simple math.
I have yet to have anyone who has an engineering background come on and not answer, of course, it's just math. Okay. I always tell people the two answers I get that are most common is yes, of course, it's just math or probability or, you know, some version of that. And then the people who say no will say, well, I haven't seen one. So until I see one, they're not real. I'm like, okay.
If you had have asked, will we see evidence of it in my life, in my lifetime? My answer is absolutely not.
But because you think they're too far away, we don't have the technology, or because
because we're not advanced yet enough yet.
Yeah, I think that's a fair answer. All right, you get to ask me one question to finish up. What do you got for me?
My question is, why are your listeners so focused on Bitcoin and you know, distributed currencies. Why is that a focus of your podcast?
Yeah.
Or a theme?
So I pretty much am very selfish when it comes to the podcast. I just talk about the things that I find interesting. And if people want to listen, then great. If they don't, too bad for them. It's kind of always been my approach, and I'm pretty transparent about that. So, you know, you end up finding people who have similar interests, or they find you, right? And on Bitcoin, the two things that I think, when somebody asks me why, right? Because everyone always asks me what, like, what is it? How does it work? Yeah, kind of, it's all that kind of stuff. But like, the why am I personally interested in it? I think that there are significant, and I mean like world changing implications when you get to the point of a currency no longer being a weapon against the people. And what I mean by that is, you know, take wealth inequality, for example. The number one cause of wealth inequality in the world is inflation. So through, you know, the lack of inflation adjusted wage contracts, or eating away at the savings of kind of the bottom 50% of the population that don't have investment assets and kind of all that type of stuff. The data is like pretty clear. Even there's some papers from like the IMF and things where the bottom percentages of the socioeconomic ladder, like they experience much higher levels of inflation than the wealthier population. And so when you start to look at all of that, you say there is a world where a deflationary or disinflationary monetary policy would actually create a more equitable world. Now, that doesn't mean that you get 100% benefit and no downside, right? So one of the downsides is inflation is supposed to engineer growth and consumption and kind of all of those things. But I think if you're optimizing for an equitable world, then getting rid of that inflation ends up being probably the number one most important thing you could do. It literally trumps all philanthropy, kind of everything else. The second piece to it is I actually think that this idea of auditability and provable scarcity and transparency and decentralization and lack of control is just generally where the world's going, right? So you talked a little bit about, like, you know, what happens when the assets actually have things coded into them? Well, if you understand how to read it, like, you'll actually be able to audit that, and it'll be transparently available. You'll understand, like, hey, I'm giving my data to this company and they can only use it for X purpose, right? And so we're moving more and more to a world where it's less about, like, I just trust you. And it's much more, I think people are being maybe not so far as cynical towards organizations and institutions, but definitely more about, like, prove it. And kind of let me audit, let me see. And so to me, it's like less about, do I think it's going to happen or not? I think, like, it's just the end game, right? It's just going to take a long time to get there. This is not a 1 or 2 year thing.
Okay. So I can summarize that. Like, you're excited okay. about it because of its potential to do good. So
yes.
That's okay. But when... I know I'm only allowed one question.
No, go ahead. You get as many as you want. This is a work part for me.
What's the most interesting? Like, so that's all well and good, but like I said, I'm a simple person. So what's the interesting yet, you know, good moving the peanut forward that you see happening realistically in the next 24 months?
Oh, I think right now what we're about to see is the greatest theft of wealth the United States has ever seen, simply from the $3 trillion of quantitative easing, the manipulation of interest rates. And the way that I think about this is everything that's going on macroeconomic wise, we saw in 2008, 2009, people ran for kind of inflation hedge assets in general. So gold, real estate, all that kind of stuff. I think we're going to kind of see that cycle play out again here. It's happening faster. Right. So the kind of the government intervention happened quicker. It was a bigger kind of step into the market. And so whether inflation kind of at a high level happens or not, it's more just like the fear of inflation forces people to move capital into inflation hedge assets. And I think you kind of have that. You see, you know, the Stanley Druckenmiller is going on television saying 5 to 10% inflation. Like, whether he's right or not just scares the hell out of people. And so they run into inflation hedge assets. And so for me, it's I personally believe the lack of financial education is like a national emergency, right? In terms of there's literally people in the United States and close to 50% of the population who could not explain to you how the money that they're saving in their, you know, bank account is actually worth less and less every year. Like, that's just a foreign concept to them, right? They're like, oh, I have $100 that I saved. Like, you know, next year it's worth $100 the year after.
Yeah.
Right. And so they, just like that alone, I think is, somebody once said to me, we ask people to go to work. So let's say you're a teacher, you're a fire man or woman, you're a surgeon, or you're a janitor, whatever your job is. We ask you to go be the best you can be at your job. And then we say, oh, by the way, in order to protect your wealth, you also have to be an investor, right? So you can't just save the money because it'll just get eroded away from mm-hmm. a purchasing power standpoint. Mm-hmm. So we need you to go learn about stocks or bonds or give you the money to somebody else, right? And they'll invest mm-hmm. it for you or whatever. And so the idea of Bitcoin, there's this saying in the Bitcoin community, like it's a savings technology. So basically what you can do is rather than save in dollars, you just quote unquote save and just denominate it in Bitcoin. And then therefore, because it's a deflationary structure with a disinflationary monetary schedule, basically it protects your wealth, right? And so like, I think part of this is like, when I say all this stuff, it's not lost on me that there's a portion of people who are like, that sounds insane. But I kind of think that's like where the market gets made, right? Is there's a portion of people who think like everything I just said makes a ton of sense and like that's where the world's headed. There's a ton of people who think that guy's crazy and there's no way that's going to happen. And like the market will ultimately decide, right? Of like.
But have you seen anything real that's going to be usable by the guy that doesn't understand that the $100 in his bank account next year or 2 years from now is actually going to give him less purchasing power and provides a viable alternative for him in the next 24 months?
I'm going to give you three data points that if you're not in it every day, I think this kind of surprises people, but they're like, oh, wait, something's going on here. Last year in 2019, if you take the annual transaction volumes on Apple, Venmo, and PayPal, and you compare them to what's called the adjusted on-chain transaction volume. So we take out all the exchanges, take out all of the transactions to and from exchanges, like really trying to get at like, what is the transaction volume on the Bitcoin network? The Bitcoin network did more annual volume last year than Apple, PayPal, or Venmo. So a lot of people don't realize that, like, there's a lot of activity that actually is occurring. It's just not all happening in the US in a consumer-friendly type application. So we don't think of it that way.
Right.
The second data point is there's a gentleman named Michael Saylor. He's for 22 years, he's been the CEO of a publicly traded company. The company's worth about $1.2 billion, $1.3 billion market cap, trades on the NASDAQ. He recently found himself earlier this year with $500 million of cash on his balance sheet. He's got a business that throws off about $50 million in EBITDA annually. And he was worried about the macro situation. And so over the last about 8 to 10 weeks, he has taken 85% of that balance sheet, about $425 million, and he has converted it to Bitcoin and publicly came out and said, I am going to use Bitcoin as the reserve asset on my balance sheet because I believe that every other asset I could put this wealth into or this value has a negative real return. And so again, it's only one person, but I think that you know, he basically is kind of like breaking the dam open. And so I don't think everyone's going to go run and do it, but does one guy lead to two, to three, to four, right? And so like that's another kind of data point of it's not the individual, but it's a corporate CEO, right? So like he's kind of paid to think about this stuff. But I think that's important. And then the third one is actually the OCC, which you're probably more familiar with than I am. Brian Brooks, who's now the head of the OCC, came from Coinbase, which is the largest US-based exchange. And he recently had a clarification that was issued. So this isn't a new ruling. It was just kind of they clarified that banks are legally allowed to custody crypto assets along with all the other assets. So a lot of banks kind of hid behind, oh, the OCC hasn't given us clarification. We don't want to play this game. So like, we're just not going to do anything. Now that that is out there, I think what it does is it kind of opens the door for some like M&A activity. So does, you know, the JP Morgans of the world go buy a crypto exchange or a custody or something? And then two is like, there will be some forward thinking banks that just say, hey, we're going to somehow build out services for, you know, kind of digital currencies, whatever that looks like. And so I say all those data points as like each one individually, probably doesn't matter as much, right? Kind of like it's off on its own. When you start to put these together, I think it's just you're driving in the right direction. We just don't know how long it takes to get there, how fast you're going, that type of stuff.
Super cool. So you can make a different podcast about this, like a the skeptic who does ignorance and doesn't let ignorance stand in their way asks dumb questions.
Listen, my favorite part about the podcast is that people come on and I learn much more from them than they learn from me. But this is what makes it fun, right?
No, this has been super fun for me. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Lisa, where can people find you on the internet or find out more about Fispan?
www.fispan.com. And they can find me on LinkedIn / Lisa Was Here.
Lisa Was Here. Oh, how did you get that?
I don't know. It was the first, like, Lisa S was already taken. And so anybody can have any vanity URL you want on LinkedIn still. It's the last vanity opportunity left on the internet.
I love that. Okay. Thank you so much for doing this. Yeah. And we definitely will have to do this again in the future.
Yeah. Really appreciate it. Lovely talking to you.